Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
We have now 2 years of critical investments in the areas that the people of Chicago actually care about.
Chicago finally has a new spending plan. The city's budget director breaks down what residents can expect. Southside neighbors may soon be getting greater access to health care services.
For Black families with children, that number is 39% facing food insecurity.
And making hot meals for local residents. An inside look at the Greater Chicago Food Depository's new facility. And now to some of today's top stories. The Chicago Board of Education has called a special meeting for this Friday before the newly appointed slash elected board is set to convene in January. On the short agenda, a closed session to discuss personnel matters. The current 7 board members were appointed by Mayor Brandon Johnson in late October. At the time, the mayor was believed to be working to oust current school CEO Pedro Martinez. But only the school board has the authority to do that, and it could be taken up behind closed doors on Friday. Earlier this week, the mayor appointed 10 members to join the 10 recently elected members of the board, all set to take office January 15th. Also on the board's agenda this Friday, turning the 7 Acero charter schools slated for closure into district-run schools. After 9 weeks of testimony and more than 50 witnesses, federal prosecutors are officially resting their case against former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Madigan is charged along with his longtime right-hand man, Michael McLean. The two are accused of orchestrating multiple corruption schemes. Both have pleaded not guilty. While the prosecution wrapped its case, it is still far from the end as defense attorneys began making their case today. To get caught up on the testimony, please visit our website. The CTA is getting nearly $2 billion in federal money to help extend the Red Line to the far south side. Local and federal officials had been racing to finalize funding for the Red Line extension before the end of the Biden administration. The federal dollars will help fulfill a decades-old promise to extend the heavily used train line past 95th Street down to 130th Street. CTA officials hope to start construction in 2025. The total cost is currently estimated at more than $5.7 billion. The state of Indiana has carried out its first execution in 15 years. 49-year-old Joseph Corcoran was pronounced dead at 12:44 this morning at the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City. Indiana is one of only 2 states that do not allow media witnesses, but Corcoran selected a reporter with the Indiana Capital Chronicle to be one of his handful of witnesses. Corcoran was convicted in the 1997 murders of 4 people. His attorneys fought his execution for years, arguing that he was severely mentally ill. Corcoran is the 24th person put to death in the U.S. this year. Wrecking crews have begun demolition on the former E2 dance hall on Motor Row, the site of a 2003 stampede that left 21 people dead. Last week, the Chicago Department of Buildings granted an emergency demolition order saying the 114-year-old building constitutes an actual and imminent danger to the public. In February 2003, security guards used pepper spray to break up a fight inside the crowded club. Panicked patrons rushed the main door, which only opened inward. The crush killed 21 people and injured 57. The building has been vacant since. A new owner says he plans to redevelop the site as a 21-story housing complex for seniors and incorporate a memorial to the victims. Up next, inside this year's difficult road to a city spending plan, Chicago's budget director joins us one-on-one right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Chicago's $17.1 billion spending plan is now in place for 2025, but it did not come easily. Forceful pushback from older people blocked property tax hikes, but the budget still includes over $165 million in additional taxes and fees to generate revenue. Here to discuss what this could mean for residents' wallets and the city's fiscal future is Annette Guzman, budget director for the City of Chicago. Annette, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So last year's budget negotiations with City Council, far less contentious than this year. Why were this year so difficult?
You know, I think that, we are one of many municipalities, states in this country that are facing difficult decisions that have to be made as we continue to emerge from the pandemic and a lot of the federal dollars that have really sustained and helped us recover have started to expire. And so as we look to what are the things that we want to prioritize for our communities, what are the things that we need to expand because of new threats that might be coming from incoming administrations, these are the difficult conversations that we fortunately or unfortunately were one of the first to have.
Mayor Johnson first said that when he first proposed that property tax hike, that it was a very difficult decision made after an excruciating process. He later said that his proposal was designed to get older people's attention. Why not start the process behind closed doors where some of that ugliness can be worked out rather than proposing publicly an unpopular idea?
You know, I think, you know, hindsight is 20/20. In a lot of cases. And, you know, we did have a lot of conversations with alders before the mayor introduced his budget. You know, there are a lot of things that we have to hold in balance when we're having discussions about budgets, having discussions about services to provide to communities, having discussions about priorities for not only next year, but, you know, 5-10 years from now. And, you know, with a season that for me starts in January, you know, those conversations start in earnest, but a lot of times because of the many things that we're balancing, it does take, you know, the introduction of the budget sometimes to have some of those conversations in more earnest. I will say that, you know, the introduction of a property tax to begin with was one that was made based on what we're looking at, you know, in out years as well. You know, because we are mostly governed with revenues that are under state law, and we have a subset that we can put in place under home rule authority, you know, we're always looking to, you know, the most stable of a revenue source so that in out years we can depend upon revenues that are going to come in. And property taxes are the most stable for municipalities to put in place.
So that said, the budget did pass this week without that property tax, but an increase in multiple other fines and fees, for example, streaming and cable services, parking garages, ride-hailing surcharges, and then some cuts from some other places, getting organizers of special events, for example, to pay the Chicago Police Department for overtime, cutting 10 deputy mayors from the mayor's office. Are you concerned that people will, you know, consider this array of smaller taxes and fee hikes just as difficult as one larger increase?
You know, when we worked with alders, because these were identified through conversations with members of City Council to replace the $300 million property tax, you know, we look at all of our revenue sources to see when was the last time that we looked at it, when was the last time that we touched it, and how has the economy changed since that time. A lot of these had not been looked at in over a decade, and yet the price of goods and services has gone up, and the city, despite having to, you know, administer a number of programs, had not had its revenues grow at the same rate as some of the costs that it takes to actually administer those programs. And so in conversations with members of City Council, they asked us the question, you know, which ones are the ones that we haven't touched, that we haven't looked at in a long time? And is there room based on where the economy has grown or changed for us to make some changes, whether small or large, to bring in more revenue? And so that's how this kind of slate of additional revenue sources came about.
Now, the city is on a watch list for credit rating downgrade. How concerned are you about that?
I think any municipality would be concerned about a downgrade because it goes towards how expensive your debt might be. And for a city of our size, where we have a lot of infrastructure projects that are necessary to ensure that, you know, our communities are safe from a public safety standpoint, that, you know, we are able to develop our communities to incentivize businesses to come and, you know, set up shop and help that community thrive, we're always concerned that we have the necessary resources to do that. You know, we are talking pretty study regularly with our credit rating agencies, helping them to understand how so much of what we did is structural in nature, meaning that these are revenue sources that will be available to us year after year, and that these are not those one-time fixes that are delaying and putting off costs into the future. And so those are the same arguments we're going to be making to our rating agencies, that, look, we did a lot. We cut over $300 million of expenditures out of this budget. We raised over $400 million, actually, you know, more than that, in this budget of additional revenue, so that we can make sure that these types of structural imbalances don't continue into the future.
The City Council narrowly passed this budget, 27-23. What do you take away from that?
I take away that we have some additional conversations that we have to have in the next year, helping members of City Council understand where our financial trajectory is going, helping them have those conversations in their communities, especially helping our residents understand the value of government in their day-to-day lives. You know, a lot of people don't have a sense every day of every single thing that the government is providing in their communities, but once those things are not there, they realize how much they depend upon them. And so I think it's incumbent upon us, whether it's the mayor's office or members of City Council, to always help them and help our communities understand these are the things that we provide, and these are things that we're happy to provide and we want to provide, because we know how they contribute to the thriving nature of our communities.
Just 30 seconds left. How are you ensuring that you are not in an even more difficult position this time next year?
I think it's beginning this process a lot earlier next year. You know, we have developed a forecast that's multi-year in nature. And so what we did this year will help mitigate a lot of next year's budget gap as well.
Okay. Annette Guzman, Budget Director for the City of Chicago. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, efforts to bring greater access to health care on the city's south side. Chicago's South Side residents have a 30-year life expectancy gap compared to their North Side counterparts. Advocate Healthcare is working to address that disparity with a new billion-dollar investment plan that includes replacing Trinity Hospital with a new facility. Stakeholders say the goal is to improve the health and well-being of residents by focusing on prevention, disease management, and increasing access to care. Joining us now are Michelle Blakely, president of Advocate Trinity and Advocate South Suburban Hospitals, Sona Jones, chief health and well-being officer for the YMCA of Metropolitan Chicago, and 7th Ward Alderman Greg Mitchell, representing communities like South Shore, South Chicago, Avalon Park, and Calumet Heights. Welcome, all of you. Thanks for joining us. And I think congrats on what sounds like a very big announcement that you all made yesterday. Michelle Blakely, how will this investment address health disparities for Southsiders?
I am so happy to be able to talk about this. So we have this broad, really bold vision to change how we approach health delivery and really create health and wellness as opposed to attacking just simply illness. And so our investment, this $1 billion, I love saying $1 billion with the B, is very comprehensive in that $500 million of it will be specifically targeted around ambulatory services and access to ambulatory care. We believe if we can get ahead of chronic diseases and help people access health care where they live in a way that's convenient, we will change the whole path around how healthcare looks. $200 million of that is going towards chronic condition management and also the social drivers of health. Part of what the solution is for healthcare is not related to what happens in a hospital at all. It's around access to food, access to employment, access to opportunities to exercise. And so that's $200 million of that, as well as an an attack on maternal health and how we address pre and postnatal services. So that's $700 million of my $1 billion going towards a very proactive strategy for healthcare. And then should a patient need a hospital, we are introducing a new state-of-the-art facility. That's $300 million of that investment to absolutely provide for that community a new state-of-the-art facility that is there to do things that you do in a hospital, should you need that access. My hope is you don't ever need my beds.
Yeah. Right, we're gonna come back to those hospital beds in a little bit as well. Sona, tell me about the YMCA and the role that it plays in this plan.
I mean, this is such an amazing, when we heard that Advocate was making this investment, we couldn't have thought of a more values-aligned organization to really accelerate our vision and our strategic transformation that's underway, which is thinking less about fitness centers or sort of this gym and swim, and more about how do we start to create facilities and community hubs that are dedicated to changing health outcomes, right? And that is a complete paradigm shift in how we think about our work. And what's so exciting about this partnership is that, you know, we were just talking about this, where you've usually got health over here and well-being over here. And this is the and, right? We're bringing them together and saying to people, hey, you know what, if you're dealing with chronic condition management or if you're trying to prevent a chronic condition, here's a place where you can find a community to build healthy habits, do it in a way that is fun and playful, and I think what we're all sort of looking for. And so that's why, you know, the why, that is what we stand for and what we have stood for in the Southside for 40 years and in Chicago for over 150 years. But really just like an amazing values-aligned partnership that I think is going to change health outcomes and keep people out of hospital beds.
And specifically, the South Shore YMCA will be serving as the first of 10...
Southside, that's right.
Southside YMCA will be serving as the first of 10 new community-based health centers.
So we're calling these neighborhood care sites, and it's through a partnership with like-minded organizations that are trusted partners in the community. And so for a person who normally accesses the Y, and the fact that they can actually receive urgent care visit there, chronic condition management there, it makes it easier for them to access services in a way that is so convenient that it's hard not to avail themselves of what we have to offer. It's hyperlocal, and it is designed to be both screening for social drivers and also providing an advanced practice provider in a virtual way. So new technology. A virtual way to receive that care. So we believe it's an innovative approach.
Alderman Mitchell, not leaving you out. What does this investment mean for residents of the 7th Ward?
Oh, all right. So I get I'm getting a double benefit from Advocate. Not only do we get a world-class hospital that's going to provide world-class health care, I also get a $300 million investment in my ward, and I'm humbled by that. And I'm happy that I can bring that to the community. What I anticipate happening is that this is going to spark, this is the catalyst. This is going to spark more investment, more interest in the community, and all those negatives we can start addressing. We can attract business that's going to provide goods and services to the community that they need and want. I have a lot of vacant properties. We lost home ownership. I anticipate this catalyst is going to revitalize my community, and those ills that we've experienced over the last 10, 15, 20 years will start to turn around.
So despite high rates of what we know about, you know, illnesses on the South Side, high rates of hypertension, diabetes, congestive heart failure, and others, hospital beds on the South Side, though, only have a 40% utilization rate. Michelle Blakely, do we have a sense of why that is?
Well, there probably are multiple reasons for that. Certainly one of the reasons is healthcare is changing in general. There's a move towards ambulatory care. There's a move towards managing even surgeries differently. So the length of stay post a surgical procedure used to be several days. Now it's just a day or two. So in part, healthcare is changing. The other reason for the South Side is we have older infrastructure, and people are choosing healthcare in different ways, and they're going to hospitals that are more modern, that have different technology. So when we did our community listening sessions, part of what we heard is your infrastructure's old. I'm not sure if I'm going to get the state-of-the-art care from your hospital that I would get from another hospital.
And to be clear, so this new updated hospital then, it is shifting from currently at Trinity, you've got 205 beds, it's going to be a lot smaller, 52 beds.
Yes.
You still feel confident that that is enough to meet community needs?
Absolutely, and let me talk a little bit about that, right? So right now, people are using hospitals, particularly the emergency room, for primary care. Once we infuse the market with access to care, and people can access care in an outpatient space, and we get ahead of chronic diseases, and we create health and wellness, you don't need a hospital for that level of care. What you then use the hospital for is what we would desire. You have an acute care episode, you come in for an elective procedure, you come in and you're discharged.
The kind of things that,
exactly
that require
what we want,
you to
right?
be there. We're almost out of time, so I want to get Sona and hopefully Alderman Mitchell back in here one more time. Separate from the listening sessions that Michelle just mentioned, the YMCA also did a comprehensive report from Southside Neighbors. What did you all find?
I think it's a lot of what's reflected in this, which is that we're looking for community-based care, that the services really aren't adequate, and that we're looking for more solutions that are community-driven and based on sort of what we're hearing. And so I think, yes, upgrading facilities, I think increasing access points to a diversity of services, right? What we know across the board is that people aren't just thinking about their fitness over here. They're thinking about fitness, mental, social, all of those things connected, and that, I think, was validated by everything we learned.
5 seconds left. Alderman, what is next? How do we make sure that this all goes down, that it all happens?
I have work to do. I joked with President a little while ago, so we're joined, and we're officially joined at the hip. So everything that needs to happen on my side to make this a reality, I'm prepared to do.
He's on it. Okay, yeah. Alderman Greg Mitchell, Sona Jones, Michelle Blakely, thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Up next, new efforts to combat hunger. But first, a look at the weather. The Greater Chicago Food Depository is a nonstop operation serving hundreds of organizations across Chicago. With food insecurity on the rise, the food bank has opened a new facility focused on preparing hot meals. Our Joanna Hernandez gets an inside look at their operations.
At the food bank on the southwest side, the operation is all about teamwork. From cutting vegetables to fruit, to preparing and packing food trays to more than 800 food pantries, soup kitchens, and shelters throughout Chicago.
We have pantries in every community. I mean, that is the reality.
I mean, you go all the way from uptown,
yeah,
all the way to West Pullman.
Yeah. Sometimes the repack team will tell them, you know, you've just repacked 17,000 pounds of food today. It is likely to go to this community or that community.
This year, the organization completed the expansion of its 38,000 square foot commercial kitchen, known as the Nourish Project. Chief Operating Officer Jill Ramon says it's a game changer for their mission to end hunger.
You might not have a kitchen. You might not have the capability to cook. You might not have the energy to cook. Might not be well enough to cook. And so we needed to build this facility to produce meals.
With more space for food production, Ramon says the goal of this new facility is to make and distribute 10,000 ready-to-eat meals daily.
We had to make food that was healthy. And healthy needed to be defined by something that we could go back to and say it's not just our idea of healthy. We're committing to the DASH diet. So it's rich in fruits and vegetables, it's rich in whole grains, it's rich in lean proteins, low in dairy fat, and low in sodium. But because they make all the marinades, we can control the taste.
We'll see what happens, but still, $12.50 is a lot.
Executive Chef Michael Goss is in charge of overseeing daily food operations.
At any given time, we may have 18 to 20 different recipes in the works.
Chef Goss transitioned from fine dining to collaborating with dietitians at the food bank to cook up meals from scratch, anything from chicken, fish, soup, and your occasional hot dog meals.
The overall goal is to feed people. We want them to eat the food that's prepared, so it needs to be, you know, tasty and really high quality. And there's no reason that nutritious or healthful foods can't be those things.
I'll break one more rule here and take you guys into the pack. This is where the meals get assembled.
Meals prepared here are distributed to 34 community partners throughout Chicago and Cook County, including 2 state-run facilities for asylum seekers. Ramon says they are focused not only on providing groceries, but meals that cater to older adults who have disabilities or chronic health conditions.
So we have about 340 older adults that will get a mixed box of meals. So they'll get 5 to 7 meals, different entrees, and a hot meal on that delivery, and we deliver directly to their home.
The facility also grows its own herbs, like growing parsley, basil, and oregano using hydroponics. Our final stop of the tour is a room full of volunteers, packing boxes to send out to local pantries.
this group of generous volunteers who are giving us what is most precious, which is time, are repacking those potatoes into smaller bags, and then they'll put them into boxes. They will then go into inventory.
With one in five households experiencing food insecurity, Rahman says the number of people in need continues to grow since the pandemic.
While this is definitely a season of giving, what we want to remind people is that this is a need that those who are in need face every day, not just Thanksgiving and Christmas.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
And if you know someone facing food insecurity, the Food Depository offers a list of resources for assistance programs. You can visit our website to learn more. And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. A crop of new tech apps connecting temps with jobs, what it means for those workers. And we hear about efforts to save the Illinois state insect. Local conservationists on what's being done to protect the monarch butterfly. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.